Hi, my name is William Henderson.
And I'm B. McGraw.
And this is the Unjerked podcast. So what we do is, unlike B. McGraw's website, which is
the Journal of Astrological Big Data Ecology, or JABDE.com.
So unlike that website, instead of writing fake academic journal articles, we look at real academic journal articles and see what we can find out about specific topics that are often talked about on Reddit and Twitter. So this is part three of our episode on higher education. So we're going to pick up where we left off.
It's our junior episode.
But anyways, like, who owns student debt? So the Brookings Institute looks into this. And, you know, the reality is, I mean, you know, college, wealthier people go to college. And so wealthier people are more likely to hold student loan debt. And so it says the highest income 40% of households own 60% of the outstanding debt. The lowest income 40% hold under 20% of outstanding debt. There are people who, you know, didn't finish college. There's cases like that, but on average, people who own student debt tend to be wealthier than people who don't. And I think that's part of the controversy behind forgiving student loan debt. And so let's talk about some of the gaps. So yes, people who go to college are wealthier and have better life outcomes on average, but there's edge cases. So 38, so according to the Pew Research Center, 38% of people who go to college do not finish within 6 years, which is much higher than I expected. And a big issue, so Brookings looks at the for-profit college system. So most colleges, whether they're private or public, they tend to be nonprofit institutions. And what you see with for-profit schools is that, you know, 10% of students go to for-profit schools, but they are half of all the student loan defaults. They tend to have worse life outcomes than both private and public nonprofit schools. And there's this article from Cornell that essentially says, you know, this is not just explained by differences in, you know, other correlative factors. This can actually be traced specifically to attending a for-profit school. They just tend to not be good schools. So that's one gap in the system where people, you know, suffer, I suppose, is like people who don't finish school. The other is for-profit schools, degree mills. And the third is just the overlap between the lowest paying college outcomes and the highest paying non-college outcomes. So when you look at, you know, how much do tradespeople make? From what I've seen, it seems like it varies from like 45K to 100K, depending on skill level, how dangerous the job is. More dangerous jobs pay more. But that seems to be, does that sound about right?
Yeah, that's what I would suspect.
Yeah. And so, you know, so if you go to Forbes, Forbes's college list, they're actually much more focused on actual financial outcomes. They used to be much more, you know, traditional metrics, but they're a lot more financial outcomes based. And you can filter for, you know, median salary 10 years after graduation. So when you're like 32 years old, roughly speaking. And the highest, at least in 2023, the highest was MIT at 182K. Or 182.8K median salary. I don't know if that includes bonus and stuff, but like,
oh wow.
MIT, Harvey Mudd, Princeton, Stanford. I mean, you know, the usual suspects. When you look at the lowest paying schools, and I believe this is like the top 500 or 600 schools. So this probably doesn't include most degree mills and places like that. But, you know, I'm not going to name the names of these colleges, but the lowest paying had median 10-year salaries of like 80K, 90K, something like that. So on the surface, you could be like, well, that, you know, that pays more than most, you know, some tradespeople make more than 80K, like, you know, very dangerous, you know, working at an oil well, you know, like, you know, there's certain jobs that pay more than that, but it seems like most tradespeople make less than 80K or 90K.
Yeah, I'd say most people, yeah.
But when you look at college major, that's when the difference becomes more notable. So there's this paper from Georgetown, or it's a white paper from Georgetown, and it looks at, you know, ages 25 to 59. So this looks at basically the whole working age population and the median salary for different college majors. The highest is, you know, engineering, comp sci, you know, business, et cetera, which is not very surprising. But when you look at the lowest paying majors, so education pays about 45 to 50K, psychology and social work about 50K, arts about 50K. So there does seem to be an overlap where, you know, those degrees pay less than the trades pay, right? I mean, if you're a trade, you know, if you're working the trades, you'll probably make more, a little more than 50K, you know, or you might make up to 100K depending on, you know, what particular trade you're in. I mean, this is not a perfect comparison because, like, I feel like the people who go into the trades are like a very different demographic from people who go into education, you know, like, I feel like, you know, I feel like people are like, well, you know, I could either teach kindergarten or like, you know, I could, you know, work on power lines. Like, I don't think it's the same person who usually like picks between those two career fields.
No.
But it's a thing. I mean, like there are, you know, if you go to a very low ranking college and you choose the wrong college major, like, you probably will make less money than someone who becomes an electrician or who becomes, you know, does like,
but here's the thing, like I'm not saying that, and I don't think anyone would say that none of those studies should exist, but maybe you could scale how much money, we as a society, like if these loans are subsidized by the government, and there clearly is a economic value associated with them, maybe we can scale how we lend out that money based on how it's used by major, if there is such a clear expectation on how much it's worth.
I mean, that would be politically tough to implement, I feel like.
But we're not politicians.
Alternatives, I mean, I think trade school is a great idea.
Could slip that in.
But, you know, so what are the alternatives to college? I think for a lot of people who are not academically gifted, going to trade school makes a ton of sense, I think. You know, it seems like there's a limit to how far you can replicate. Because, like, college used to be, like, Harvard used to be, like, the only university in the United States before we were even, you know, we were still British colonies back then, but it was just Harvard. And obviously, like, you know, if you argued back then, like, oh, we shouldn't have any more universities, one is enough. Like, obviously that's ridiculous.
Yeah, but that would be insane.
But I feel like there's a point where it's like, how far can you replicate this? Because if you have a four-year college, that's ranked like 900th in the country. And, you know, the average person who graduates makes like 35K. Like, is that really, you know, I feel like that, you know, I feel like the model can only scale so much before, you know, you have diminishing returns. As far as coding boot camps go, so it's tough to like
coding boot camps work.
So, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that, like, you know, having an actual computer science degree is much more marketable in the job market than going to a coding boot camp. That's pretty obvious. There's not a lot of data on, you know, according to Forbes, there's not a lot of data on the actual outcomes of different boot camps. But it says the median cost is $9,500 and the most common salary increase was between $10,000 and $20,000. So from a purely financial perspective, that seems pretty reasonable.
Yeah, that would make sense. And honestly, this might be something that I bet could trickle down to companies who need software developers. Most software development, you don't need a computer science degree. Like, you don't need to take discrete mathematics to need to know how to develop a website.
Right.
And some of my other, like, programmer friends that are in academia, we've complained about this a lot, is when you're in, like, these comp sci courses, you get kind of two types of people. Some that are there for the computer science and are really interested in some of the more advanced stuff, like whatever, like quantum computing or like actual, you know, really, really advanced software architecture. And then you have like a good portion of people that just want to learn how to code, get out and do programming.
Yeah, just for the money. Code monkeys, basically.
Yeah, you know, some people just want to be code monkeys, and they don't want to have to like learn about sorting algorithms. They just need to know how to do it. Like, I think there's a lot of space there that's starting to develop now.
There is space. I think, I guess the overarching thing is, like, there shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all approach.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm saying, and what I'm noticing is, like, I think there really is space for people just learning how to code, because, like, there's also a lot of jobs where, like, yeah, if you can hire a coder cheaper than someone who's got, like, a full comp sci degree, yeah, you're going to do that. I bet.
Yeah. I think apprenticeships, learn and earn programs, there should be more of that, like having the chance to actually do work experience while you're learning. As far as MOOCs go, so massive online, open online courses. So this research, you know, there's this paper that looks at, you know, what are their, you know, do they work? And this is, they look in the context of like
some MOOCs,
massive open online courses. So like OpenCourseWare. They're looking at it from the perspective of using it as a supplement within a course, that like within an in-person course. And they said that it had a positive influence based off a survey.
Oh, that's good.
So it seems like it helps as a supplement.
One more comment on the coding boot camps. And this is probably related, is I think they saw that tend to, and I feel like I read this somewhere, but I don't know where. The $10,000 to $20,000 bump in your salary probably has to do with people with normal office jobs that learn how to code, and then that suddenly makes them more valuable or more useful in the office. And I think we as a society are getting to a point where if you're working a white-collar job, you should probably learn how to code.
Yeah, agreed.
It makes you more valuable as a person.
Right.
In a professional environment.
Right. So yeah, MOOCs seem to help when it comes to supplementing a course. They didn't go into, I think there's sort of like, because like every course that you can really take exists online somewhere if you really look for it. I mean, maybe not every, but like most major subjects, you can find all that info online.
Yeah.
Some universities
if you want to, you can learn about anything you want.
Yeah. I think the two issues, one is how do you signal that? Cause like you can't really prove, you know, maybe you can get a certificate or say you pass it, but like you could easily, you know, look up the answers for like the quiz portion of one of those online.
Oh yeah.
Things. And also like there's a pedagogical value in having an actual professor who can like answer your questions and stuff and explain concepts to you. So I feel like there's a limit to what MOOCs can accomplish.
Yeah.
I think there should be more national service. There should, you know, some countries have a gap year where you spend that time doing some sort of, it's either conscription or it's more broader, like working in the civil service of some kind. I think.
Yeah. I think national service should be more of a thing, because also that just gives everyone, you know, job experience across the board.
So solutions to the problem. So, you know, I think there's a couple options, I think. And I'm mostly talking about like the higher student, the student loan problem, basically. How do we lower tuition? Usually the answer in my mind is like just have a pricing mechanism. And so, you know, just get rid of loans altogether. But the problem with that is like you'll just have, you know, essentially a class of people who cannot afford to go to college and don't get educated. And I think in most other cases, I'd be like, well, that's just how it works. But I think in the case of education, there's just a massive social benefit in people getting educated. So,
yeah,
you know, I think price controls might not be a bad idea. And the thing with price controls is that they lead to shortages. And so this is one of those cases where I'm like, well, maybe there should be a shortage and there should be some sort of selection mechanism. So in the German model, they basically decide, you know, pretty early on, you know, when you're in middle school or high school or whatever, they're like, okay, who is on track to go to college and who's on track to like, you know, go into the trades or something like that. And so only 28% of people go to college in Germany, but the people who do go, basically it's paid for by the government.
What if you used, and this is like kind of the earlier idea I was kind of riffing on, you made the pricing mechanism either through how much you're willing to let people borrow for a student loan or within the college itself, be scaled by your expected life outcome, because you might pay the same amount for an education degree versus a computer science degree, mm-hmm. but your expected life outcome is going to be very different, earnings wise.
Yeah. I think the danger to that is universities might just say, you know, we only bring in X amount of dollars from like people who study education. And so we can't fund the education department enough.
I
feel like that's the argument that would be made.
Well, yeah. Well, that's the thing is like, if people were completely rational, then like, why would you like go to these lower paying fields? But, you know, there's no way around the fact that as a society, you need people that are going to be in education and teach fields.
You know, teachers are a very important part of society, as are social workers. The sort of perverse thing is careers where people are more likely to be passionate about doing their job tend to be lower paying jobs, because, you know, I think when people are less passionate about their jobs, they're like, well, if you want me to do this thing, you need to pay me. Whereas I think when people are like, this is the right thing to do, and I want to do this because it's good for society, a lot of those people are willing to accept lower salaries. I mean, that's, you know, it's something people don't want to talk about, but it's a thing.
I think it's a little bit more than that. And here's a counter example is, if you are a doctor, I think most people that go through all of the process of a medical school and your residency and all of the work associated with that, they're usually pretty passionate about it. I don't think most people strictly go in for the money.
I do think there's people.
I know like some people do, but I bet most medical professionals do it because they're passionate.
There's
about
a supply
it, and they with, get with, taken advantage of because of that, considering how much they work.
Medicine's different because there's a supply constriction. There's only so many residency slots. There's also, I mean, you need legitimate years and years of training to actually be an effective doctor. I mean, no offense to someone who's a high school teacher, but like the amount of training you need to teach high school is like much less than the amount of training to be a good brain surgeon. I mean, it's not even close. Not saying one's more important than the other, but I think it makes it difficult to make a direct comparison. I think moving on, you know, I think so. The German model is basically college is free, but only some people get to go. Slight modification might be to also subsidize trade school as well, because if you just subsidize college, then it's basically a subsidy for wealthier people ultimately.
Or the people capable enough to get into those programs, and they're not going to need as much help.
Another might be, you know, like we mentioned before, national service. Maybe make college free or trade school free for people who do national service. That already exists in the military through the GI Bill, but maybe that should be expanded to the AmeriCorps, the Peace Corps, State Department, National Parks. There's a lot of different departments in the federal government. And I think it would be really cool if basically anyone who was willing to do 2 years of national service could get their school paid for. Like, I think that'd be amazing.
I would be super down for that. I think that would also be pretty popular as well.
It'd be popular, and it'd just be a really good way to go to other parts of the country and to serve and to learn about, gain that civic pride and learn about what other people are doing. I think there's just so much there. There's just a lot of potential there. And then finally, I think one thing I heard is like make universities guarantors for student loans. So if the student defaults, then the university has to pay off the remaining balance. I think there one danger with this is like it could turn off universities to higher credit risk students, which is typically poor students. So they might not accept poor students because they're more likely to default on loans. So there is a risk there, but it's something else to think about. Because right now, like, you know, once you graduate, like the university doesn't care what happens to your student loans. Like, you know, don't want to sound harsh, but that's the reality. So that's something else to think about.
Or even if you don't graduate. They're not banking on you giving to the alumni society.
Right. I mean, you know, they're probably just like, you know, they probably calculate like what, you know, who will and who will not donate, whatever. So that kind of covers everything. There's a few tiny things I want to mention also. International students, how did they fit into the picture? I think the reason universities have international students is because they pay much, much higher tuition. So they're a huge source of revenue for universities. They are good, you know, I would argue they're good for the system as a whole, because more than half of Nobel Prize winners in the U.S. are people who are immigrants originally.
Oh, that's so cool.
So I do think if you, you know, pick the right people to come to study, I think it's a net benefit for sure for society.
Well, I also think there's a huge value in having an internationally diverse student body for everyone as a whole, because then you get to experience different cultures and people.
Right. And one thing that a policy that does not exist that I think should exist is what's called a staple visa. So there's different types of visas. There's student visas, work visas, etc. And it, you know, my understanding is that like if you get a PhD in the US and your student visa ends, basically, if you can't find it, basically they're like, okay, you know, thanks, now go home. Is it, you know, and if you're lucky, you can find a job in the US and get sponsored for a work visa, but it's not guaranteed. And so a lot of people who get, you know, PhDs in the US, they leave the US, and that's just a huge source of talent that we're just foregoing. Yeah. And so if you guaranteed for, you know, specific high demand fields and skill sets, I think it would be a great idea if we guaranteed work visas for people who get educated in the US. I think that would be a great idea.
Yep. I am highly in favor of brain draining all other countries. Yes.
So there's a big argument that brain drain's not as big of an issue as people think. Because a lot of times, assuming, let's say there's brain drain and someone, you know, talented person leaves a country. Yes, if they never return to the country, that's a problem. But most times there's some sort of connection with the home country. And so a lot of times when you actually look at like where the sort of new tech hubs in the world, a lot of them, you know, there's a lot of tech companies in China now, and there's, you know, there's a growing startup scene in India as well. And there's an art, and obviously there's a lot of people from China and India who work in the tech center in the US. And so there's, you know, pretty compelling evidence that a lot of those people, they, you know, maintain connections with their home country. And there's sort of a back and forth as far as talent goes. So assuming you that sort of relationship with that country is maintained, a lot of times, a lot of that talent actually flows back to the home countries. When it comes to college sports, so I think there's a big debate about, I mean, it's not a huge debate, but like what are college sports good for, basically? And I think sports in general, you know, there's obviously huge benefits to, you know, athletics aside from just physical fitness. I think it's a way to, you know, have a school community. It's a way to develop leadership skills and teamwork skills. So I think, you know, most people would argue sports are a great thing. From a purely financial aspect, though, apparently most Division I universities did not bring in net dollars from
Oh, really?
from athletics. So essentially, so football and basketball are like the huge money makers. You know, a lot of, they bring in a lot of cash, but a lot of less, you know, popular sports are cost centers actually. And so according to this research I found, like, I believe more than half of colleges, it actually cost more money than it made, interestingly enough. So I thought that was interesting. A separate debate.
Is that just from like ticket revenues only, or? Because I imagine that some colleges bring in students that come because they have good sports programs to watch.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely part of it too. I mean, that analysis kind of gets a little more difficult, but they're talking about generated revenues here. It's ticket sales, NCAA and conference distribution, contribution from alumni, bowl revenue, other, etc. And, you know, it seems to be, let's see if we can open this up here.
But can you really put a price on pride?
So when you look at net generated revenue, which is generated revenue minus total expenses, so it seems like it was mostly net negative. And it depends on the specific university, but a lot of universities actually use a net cost center. There's a big debate about, should college athletes be paid? My answer is, like, of course they, like, why shouldn't they? I mean, I think
if they're bringing in money, yeah.
The main argument, I guess there's like an argument from jealousy where it's like, you know, they're already the cool kids and now they're going to make a lot of money too. Like, you know, like
I listened to a debate on it, and I think most of the criticism is like, you're basically going to turn the college sports into like a professional league, and now you're just going to get people that are in it for the money and not for the sportsmanship of it all. I'm like, I think you can be in it for the, like, sportsmanship and make some money.
It would be a argument to make if, like, nobody was making money from college sports, but, like, you know, TV networks make a ton of money from college sports, and there's like a lot of, you know, coaches make a ton of money from college sports. So to say, like, oh, well, they can make money, but the athletes can't because it's not sportsmanlike to make money is like a dumb argument. And you know, my view is like, they, you know, like, they're the ones doing it. Like, why can't they get paid? Like, it just seems like a reasonable.
And also, college athletes generally put in a lot of work. Like, we knew people that were sportsmen in college, and the amount of extra work they put into their athleticism on top of getting a degree, that's like, it just felt like a crime that they weren't getting anything extra.
And a lot of them also, you know, get pretty serious injuries.
Yeah, there's risks associated. Yeah.
Yeah. And so for me, it's a pretty obvious, like, I think they should get paid whatever they can get on the market. You know, so there's that. And then the final, before we wrap up, the final thing is like, okay, how does, like, let's say there's a university in your city, what is the net impact on that, on the community itself? And I couldn't find any good answers. You know, there's, you know, obviously the university has, you know, employment opportunities. I mean, frankly, a lot of them are mostly for people from outside the community, like, you know, professorships. You're not going to have local people, you know, becoming professors at a university. It's mostly going to be people from, you know, other states or other cities, right? And then also, you know, most universities have tax exempt status. So that's a huge tract of land where there's no, you know, property taxes being raised. And then on the flip side, you know, a lot of innovation happens at universities. And, you know, if it's a very good research university, you can have a lot of spin out companies, and that could bring in a lot of money. So there's no obvious answer. You know, the reason I even like thought about this is like, some universities are in very good cities, and then sometimes there's very good universities that are like in pretty sketchy areas. Like, I'm not going to name names, but there's a lot of universities that are like a couple blocks away from like really sketchy neighborhoods. And I always thought like, it's weird. Like you'd think some sort of benefits would flow out from the university to, you know, the local area, but you know, I guess it's not an obvious clear cut thing. So that kind of wraps things up. I think the part I wanted to talk about the most is, you know, the student loan thing. You know, why does college cost so much? And the answer is colleges are just, they're just spending money galore. They're just spending tons and tons of money because they can get away with it, because people will keep knocking on the door, because people keep taking loans out. And so colleges just, you know, keep expanding and expanding their administrative bloat, and they just spend money on tons of things that they probably don't have to. And that is basically the problem.
Yeah. And also it's kind of interesting how inconclusive it is, actual life outcomes, but it's also kind of a, hard thing to study in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think, I don't really think student loans should be a thing unless they were optional. I think, you know, some sort of system of subsidizing, you know, the next step after high school, whether it's college or whether it's trade school, I think that would be a lot better. That would be much more likely to instill cost discipline in universities. You know, if the federal government was basically, it's basically incentives. If they were incentive, if they're like, hey, I'm paying for this as the government, you better rein in your costs. Incentives are a lot more aligned than, hey, I'm getting money from people who borrowed money from me as the government, and so I'm making money from costs going up. I think that's a big difference in incentive alignment. So I kind of, you know, I almost feel like student loans shouldn't even be a thing for the most part. It should mostly be.
Yeah. Well, I think like it should either be free or you have student loans. But if you are going to have student loans, I think there should be more discrimination on who gets them.
Perhaps.
In an equitable and fair way, at least. Because like if you start making it only profitable motives, then you clearly get problems from that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think
make it more of a meritocracy and how you use it.
This is a good example of an episode where the problem comes, I mean, there's the phrase like the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Like the reason this problem exists is because of a policy that was supposed to be helpful. You know, the reason why student loans
were guaranteed. And it's probably helped a lot of people too.
Yeah. I mean, the reason why we have this problem is that the government subsidizes, you know, student loans for everyone basically. And that does mean that almost everyone can go to college if they academically qualify. The flip side is you're paying for that on the back end. So like this isn't because there were evil people who came in, you know, people online blaming or saying like, you know, interest rates should be 0%. I'm like, well, that just makes the problem even worse. That, you know, reduces the pricing signal even more. And, you know, or people who are like, oh, well, the banks, I'm like, well, the banks don't own the student loans. The government owns the student loans. So like you see all these people angry at the wrong people. And I'm like, well, the problem is like we collectively decided on a policy that ended up backfiring big time. So this is a case where like nobody did this out of malice. It just kind of ended up happening. And the solution would be kind of, I mean, what if the government said, hey, we're not going to let you borrow money to go to college? Like, I feel like that'd be pretty unpopular.
Oh my gosh. So many people. Well, the problem is so many people that should go to college won't because of that.
Yeah. So anyways, that's it for us. And we will see you next time. So please like and subscribe.
Yep. See ya.